For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, your two favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle. This is Metaphysics 102, subtitled Tim and Mark's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah! At last! I've been waiting for this day for a long time.
Yep, the metaphysical phone booth is waiting right outside the cave door here.
Man.
We just got to hop in and we can go anywhere, Tim.
Well, fantastic. What a fun movie that is. I'm going to point out as a quick aside, the 1980s, in my estimation, were the pinnacle of American culture when it comes to fashion, movies, music, and it was so fantastic that there's a halo effect carrying into the 90s. So in pop culture, so Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is part of that crowning achievement of American culture.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I know you're being a little facetious, but I honestly think when it comes to film, I think you've got a strong argument there. I mean, there's so many great films that came out.
Well, especially comedies.
Yeah, comedies, right. Yep. The whole genre of comedies in the late 1980s and bleeding into the early 1990s.
Yes.
You're exactly right.
And they did things we couldn't do today.
Oh, yeah.
Like Blazing Saddles.
I was thinking exactly.
Eddie Mel Brooks.
Yeah, Mel Brooks would not
but
fly.
But Bill Murray, I mean, who happens to be a pretty good Catholic.
Right.
By the way, he did a lot of great movies. In fact, that whole kind of SNL cast from the 70s, many of them launched film careers into the...
So many underrated Dan Aykroyd movies out there.
Oh, yeah. With John Candy, how about in The Great Outdoors?
Yep, John Candy also.
What was the name of that? What was it, like a 64-ounce steak and if you ate the whole thing?
Exactly, yeah.
I would call it The Widowmaker, but that wasn't it. It was called something else. And then he tries to finish it, and then it's like, but you got to eat the grizzle. That's nasty.
Yeah, The Great Outdoors. Is one of those underrated movies, definitely.
Yeah. But those comedies had just scenes that just are immortal and immortally funny. And then they had there's some dead spots in there and stuff like that, but there's some just absolutely classic.
But I will
Caddyshack,
right? But I will say, as a parent, you unfortunately have a little bit of amnesia about some of those scenes, and so you get this idea of like, I'm going to show my 12-year-old this movie, and you realize, ooh, this was a major mistake.
Right. Well, because again, our sensibilities have changed, our moral taste has changed. Now, here on the Catholic Cave, of course, we know that there are, and we've talked about many times, pointed to that there are perennial first principles that are immutable, unchangeable. But then, how they are applied or other matters of, say, I think Aquinas talks about, that there are matters that are simply are of taste or of preference. And so, but today, since we are going to go on an excellent adventure, it's kind of part two. This is a little bit of kind of a part two. It's a standalone episode, but part program. But it's part two of metaphysics. We're going to continue a conversation about metaphysics.
Right, right, exactly. So last week we sort of established what the science of metaphysics was, and it's the it's kind of that study of first principles and the studies of sort of the foundations, the conditions necessary for the existence, the conditions necessary for
being
and,
with a capital B and a small b.
Correct. And so I think I'm going to start by bringing up the person who brought into question that whole enterprise, David Hume. So David Hume,
yes,
very famous,
super important thinker, by the way.
Right.
Even though I don't agree with Well, some of what he says.
No, I don't. It's very hard. It's very hard to agree with David Hume. But honestly, the agreement, you know, he's one of those people that just because he got it wrong does not diminish his importance in the slightest.
Correct.
Because
or impact. He still impacts a lot of thinking today.
So David Hume was a deep, deep skeptic. And skepticism's not necessarily a bad thing. You can come to a lot of insights by just simply doubting. But he doubted. And one of the things he started to doubt was that the idea of causality, the idea of cause and effect, isn't something that we just have habitually. That we sort of, the reason we think that the sun's going to rise up tomorrow is because it did yesterday and it did the day before, and we're just sort of habituated to this understanding.
That there's not real linkage.
Right. There's not.
Between cause and effect.
Well, and it's not even so much that there's not real linkage, but any linkage that there is based on our own experience.
Oh, right.
In other words, there are no metaphysical truths that aren't empirical truths. It was sort of what the bottom line. And so, you know, it's not that the point of him doubting cause and effect wasn't so much to doubt that somehow the sun's going to rise tomorrow or to try to live a life where you expect, you know, I always picture Jim Henson's Muppets when you're talking
about
David.
Although they've gone through a transition, unfortunately, recently.
Yeah, once again, you got to be careful what you recommend.
Right.
But, you know, if you think about
Sesame Street's off the list in my home, but
right. But if you think about Jim Henson and you think about the Muppet Show, another great '80s classic. When you get down to it, you would have sketches and things where just crazy, unexpected things would happen. You know, you'd have a chicken come in, and then suddenly the chicken would, you know, be yanked up into the air, and so you'd have chickens that don't act the way at all that you would expect chickens to act, and you would have I don't know if Jim Henson ever made such a movie, but you'd have a movie where you'd have two billiard balls collide and one of them would fly straight up in the air, right?
Defying what one's expectations or laws of physics, maybe.
And so, you know, when I think of David Hume, I think of stuff like that. And it's not the point that Hume was making was not that this could happen. You know, it could be that we just suddenly have it rain chickens. That's not the point.
There is a movie where, and I'm not recommending it, but there's a Tom Cruise movie called Magnolia, and it rains frogs, which is a really creepy thing. I think right at the end.
Right.
The whole movie's very troubling. I don't recommend it.
But once again, that wasn't Hume's point.
Right.
What Hume's point was the fact that we expect when it's going to rain, and we're watching the weather, and the weather says, you know, there's a 70% chance of showers tomorrow. We expect that to be water. Hume's point is the only reason we expect that to be water is because that's what's happened in the past.
Right.
That there's no necessity to it. Not in a metaphysical sense. And so the problem isn't just causality. What he's calling into question is the whole enterprise of metaphysics as something where you understand the conditions necessary for being, the conditions necessary for change, all of the things we were talking about last week. David Hume's claim is that those are based on empirical observation. There's nothing special about them whatsoever. This is not a separate science. This is just an extension of science as we know it. And so he called into question metaphysics and said there is no metaphysics. There's just physics. There's just the study of motion. There's just the study of reality, not a separate study of first principles and not a...
Well, material reality, I think, is what he would emphasize.
Yeah, he would emphasize material reality.
Because I think there's reality that's not material.
Right. But he
dismisses that.
But he dismisses it. And he says there is no justification for posing that there is something beyond just empirical science.
Would you say you brought up, so we could take this several different ways. Would you, I hadn't really thought about this. I'll throw this out to you, Mark. Would you say Hume is the quote unquote father or progenitor of scientism?
No, I wouldn't.
Would you say it happened earlier?
Yeah, well, or I would say other figures. And the reason why is Hume was a deep skeptic.
Right.
In other words, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week, that you've got two types of philosophers. You've got systematizers and you've got critics. And Hume mm-hmm. was a critic. He wasn't a systematizer.
Right.
And so he didn't build up a system that, right. that you could say led to a worship of science. I mean, for that, you've got to look at Francis Bacon or Locke or some of those okay. guys that are more
yeah,
systematic.
Yeah, Bacon's a troublemaker.
Right.
I mean, normally I love Bacon, especially on a Saturday morning in my new Cuisinart iron skillet. I love that kind of bacon. But Francis Bacon... very important thinker, but definitely more of an empirical scientist kind of
right.
exclusive guy.
Right. But Hume was a critic, and Hume was a critic specifically of metaphysics and specifically of metaphysical thought. And that, you know, that challenge, I think, is something that people do have to kind of take seriously. You have to look and sort of say, okay, what is the grounding for our metaphysics? And in attempting to argue that, you know, the question of what is metaphysics and is metaphysics even possible become the two predominant questions that need to be answered.
Well, I think, too, one of the well, I'm going to recommend something, kind of a book series. I guess it's more informal, not a formal series. But one of the great philosophers of our time is Peter Kraft. And he's written, who knows, 60 books or something like that, and good, very strong Catholic. And he's very accessible. So he writes at a level that I can understand so easily. So he's very accessible for anyone who wants to pick up, the vast majority of his books are very helpful. But he's written a series, I want to say there's 6 or 8 or 10 books, where he has Socrates meets, and then fill in the blank, and some of the books are Socrates meets Hume, Socrates meets Kant, Socrates meets Descartes, Socrates meets Machiavelli, blah, blah, blah. So those are some of the top of my head. So that's a great way to begin to get at some of these thinkers like Hume that we're talking about. But as I understand, or one of the features of David Hume's work that I want to get your thoughts on, I know we're coming up on a break here, is that he kind of reduces things to mere custom. And so I want to pick that up after the break.
And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford with Mark Tuttle and Tim O'Donnell. So far in our discussion of Metaphysics 102, we've covered the Bill and Ted movies, the Muppets, bacon and cast iron skillets, and we've even touched on a little bit of metaphysics.
Right.
Gentlemen, where do we go from here?
Well, right before the break, I had... brought up that one of the features, as I've read David Hume, is that he reduces, I would say, morality and ethics really to custom. And the reason why I read him that way is, as Mark had mentioned in the previous segment, he sort of decouples to a certain, I would say, in an objective sense, that the linkage between cause and effect, and that Hume locates that more in the subject or the person versus, you know, external or objective reality. So as a result, when Hume begins to do his sort of moral inquiry and criticism, he points out, and I think this is a very common the symptom is pretty common, which is that there's great variety in people's moral lives and in culture, place, time. You see great differences in moral codes and moral conduct. And that would seem to bolster Hume's position that at the end of the day, things are just custom. And so the phrase, or cosmopolitan might be a way to do it. So, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans. When you're Kokomo, do what's going on in Kokomo. And you go to Manhattan, you know, you should follow what's going on there. But it's all kind of custom. What are your thoughts on Hume and how he begins to assess or critique morality?
Well, I think it's an Occam's razors exercise for him that, you know, if you don't have any sort of metaphysical basis, then what you're left at is something that's empirical. I find his approach to religion and miracles to be equally interesting in that he doesn't call into question completely miracles, but he says, you know, to judge the validity of a miracle, you have to see what effects it brings about. So it's an empirical, it's an empirical approach to claims about religion and miracles that he says, we should be skeptical to a point, but we obviously can't completely dismiss the idea that maybe there is religion. But in order to really see what it is, you have to see what the moral fallout is of a set of religious claims, and you have to see what sort of the moral societal fallout is of a particular miracle, if there's going to be a miracle. And if, you know, bad religion leads to bad fruit. And so, you can make a judgment on these claims off of empirical observation of their sort of moral fallout. I find his application of empiricism to be really interesting in matters of religion. And you know, that's what he's left with.
He's a data guy.
That's what he's left with when it comes to trying to find a foundation for morality. But, you know, that does lead to the observation of why metaphysics matters. Because I think a lot of people are listening to the show, and as Kent started us off, is like, well, you know, you guys have talked about Muppets, and you've talked about Bill and Ted, and you've talked about all sorts of sort of silly stuff. Why on earth is this discussion in any way not only important, but what does it have to do with reality? I mean, when you're talking about cause and effect, and you're talking about form, you're talking about matter, you're talking about being, these are things that people just sort of experience. They see them, they know them in their everyday life, but do you really have to figure them out? Do you really have to spend time thinking about them? Isn't it something we can kind of just take for granted and move along?
Yeah, that's a good point. We, like much of what we encounter, I think, in our everyday lives, we don't, with the hustle and bustle and the business of it all, we don't often pause to reflect on or think about or ruminate on some of the more foundational things. So that's why metaphysics is important. Meta, you know, before. So before we look at, say, the natural world, is there something more foundational?
Yeah.
So maybe at this point, Mark, let's maybe go down the path of There's probably, what, three different schools of metaphysics?
Yeah, I would say there's probably three broad categories of metaphysical positions that people take in the modern world. So, I would say probably the most predominant one is coming off of Hume, and that is radical skepticism of metaphysical claims. In other words, there really is nothing behind the scenes. The world is a set of mechanical laws that are discoverable, are understandable, based off of the studies of physics, based off of the studies of the hard sciences. You can get a grasp of reality as it is without needing any other sort of background theory, without needing anything that you come to, you come to the study of science with. Science is self-sufficient in itself. It doesn't need another science out there, another science of metaphysics to support it. So that is one broad, and I think we could call that scientism, broadly speaking, that science gives us adequate understanding of the world. If there are questions that science doesn't seem to understand yet, it eventually will. And honestly, it's a self-support.
Which is a kind of faith, by the way.
Yeah. And I think you're right. It's a kind of faith because the claim is that this is a self-supporting set of knowledge. You don't need a foundation for the understanding of science. Science is its own foundation, and it is its own entity. You don't need something to be able to bolster it and hold it up. And I would say then the main,
which is a claim I dispute,
right? And the reason
but that is a self understanding of science,
right? And the reason you dispute it is because you hold to the what at this point is kind of the alternate view, and I would say is sort of the view that is taking the critical stance of that. And that is scholasticism. So this is the set of metaphysical principles that was developed first by Aristotle and then improved upon over the ages by various philosophers, most particularly St. Thomas Aquinas. And that is that, no, science does not account for the whole. That you have a whole, and within that whole, science can only account for a small part, material reality. Mm-hmm. But material reality to be understood, for material reality to even exist, you need to have causes. You need to have an understanding of form. You need to have an understanding of sort of what matter is and how they interact. And honestly, in order to have that, you do have to have some semblance of something coming from nothing. And you have to understand that everything ultimately came from nothing in a way that really can only be accounted for with a creator.
Yeah. And also, I think a robust scholastic metaphysics, like you said, tracing from, say, Aristotle to Aquinas, and then maybe in the current setting, I would say, We've talked about someone we're big fans of is Edward Fazer, F-E-S-E-R, and the work he's been doing there. But things like, you brought up the word intelligibility, right? And I would say that's what the hard sciences can't really account for. You can use hard science. You can use, say, a physics to discover. Say the laws, the theories of how, say, planets are a planetary motion. But the point of science of that there's discovery means that there's something out there that you can make sense of. So when you look at something like an equation, like Kepler's law of planetary motion, that explains. That's a very powerful explanatory tool on how planets move in orbit in a variety of different settings. But what it doesn't explain is how our intellect can grasp or apprehend what is it about that mode that we can apprehend it. And that intelligibility, especially for Catholics, is going to reside in metaphysics, and metaphysics being in that the source of the cosmos is a all-powerful, all-knowing, loving creator that has built into the universe intelligibility, that laws, potentialities, actualities that the human intellect can apprehend.
Right. And I'm glad you used the word intelligibility, because that really does kind of lead into the third metaphysical position. And that's what I think, broadly speaking, we can label it phenomenology. And that starts from sort of the inside of intelligibility, mm-hmm. that the universe is ultimately intelligible, and science is an explanation of that intelligibility. Mm-hmm. But that intelligibility comes because there are certain principles and there are certain, certain judgments that are made just simply from the standpoint of intelligibility and the intellect alone. So what it says is the universe is intelligible, but that's not necessarily because of the nature of the universe, but it's because of the way our minds are constructed. Our minds are constructed in a way.
Oh, you're pulling up Immanuel Kant.
Right, right. And the whole idea of phenomenology comes from that standpoint.
Socrates meets Kant. That's another Peter Craik book.
Yep, I'll have to check that one out. Yeah. That one sounds interesting. But the whole idea of intelligibility comes not because of the universe, but because of pure reason itself. That reason itself, and you know, there's definitely room to recognize that this reason that we have is because we're made in the image and likeness of our Creator. You know, we are created with intelligibility as human beings. And from our own minds, we're able then to understand to a good extent what it is we're seeing out there, the observations. But, you know, Kant, I think, came at it as a response to Hume, and that's probably the best way to explain it. Mm. Not everything can be explained through empirical observation. There are certain propositions that we just know, that we know because of reason itself, cause and effect being one of them. And so the whole idea of metaphysics is that there are propositions and judgments that we make prior to experience, prior to us coming to the universe, that can only be there because of the way our minds are constituted, can only be there because of the nature of pure reason.
And we need to take a break. We'll be back with more metaphysics right after this. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hello? Oh, Lord. Hi. How you been? Yeah. I'm sorry I haven't been picking up the phone lately. Yeah, I've been really busy doing, you know, school and work and church stuff. I know, Lord. Yeah. Yeah, baptism, right. It's kind of like 24/7. I know, I'm really sorry about that. Yeah, I definitely still want to follow you. This is definitely something I want to do for life, yeah. Uh-huh. Reconciliation? That would be a good thing? Okay, well, I'm definitely going to do that. Soon? Yes, I'm going to do that today. Okay, I love you, Lord. I love you, too.
God's calling. Are you ready to answer? Just a reminder from your friends here at Catholic Radio Indy.
Hello.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell with Mark Tuttle, Kent Blanford. Metaphysics 102, part 2 of the program, because now we're in the second half. So, Mark, right before the break, we were talking about sort of the three different camps or categories of metaphysics. I think what might be interesting at this point would be, let's think about from a Catholic philosophical perspective, and here, let's speculate a little. Out of those three camps of kind of Hume skepticism, you have sort of a scholastic camp, and then you have a phenomenological camp, maybe, you know, who's followers of, say, Kant or develop Kant's thought. Can a Catholic be in good standing, let's say, in one, two, or all three of those camps?
Well, you know, I think the obvious answer is we can take scholasticism first.
Right. Because Aquinas is in that camp.
Right.
So we know we're good.
And
because anywhere Thomas Aquinas goes, a good Catholic can go to.
Right. And, you know, I think our guidance for this discussion can be John Paul the Great's encyclical Fides et Ratio.
Oh, that's a good one.
You know, because, you know, and he holds up St. Thomas Aquinas as sort of the...
Yeah.
The,
so did not, Pope Leo the 13th.
Well, no. But John Paul II holds him up in a different way than Leo the 13th did. And I think this is really important for this discussion. John Paul II holds up St. Thomas Aquinas as an example of a philosopher and metaphysician that is still Catholic, but not, he does not hold him up as the philosopher. Now, you know, Leo the 13th arguably held up St. Thomas Aquinas.
That was the point of one of his encyclicals.
As a the philosopher. But John Paul II holds him up as, here's a guy that has an understanding of the universe that's compatible with Catholicism, and we need more philosophers that come up with philosophical systems that are compatible with Catholicism. Mm-hmm. It's not, John Paul II really was not endorsing Thomism wholehearted, saying Thomism is the only possible metaphysical stance that a Catholic can take. Mm-hmm. But he was holding up St. Thomas Aquinas as an example, and I think that's an answer to the question of can you be a good Catholic and a scholastic. It's right there. Obviously, mm-hmm. yes, you can, because you have St. Thomas Aquinas, which is almost the definition of scholasticism,
right,
is St. Thomas's system. So
clearly the head of the school.
Man. Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think when you look at most discourse that goes on within church circles, I think the supposition is we're we're dealing with at least modified scholastic metaphysical principles that we're starting mm-hmm. with. So I think when you talk about natural law and you talk about where the church is coming to a lot of their moral how the church is coming about through their moral thinking, mm-hmm. it's based off of the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas and scholasticism. So that one's an easy answer. Yes, you can right. definitely be a good Catholic and be a scholastic. Phenomenology, I think, is a little bit more complicated. Can you be a good Catholic and still hold to the truths of the Catholic of can you be a good Catholic but coming at it from the perspective of phenomenology? And I would definitely hold up John Paul II again as an example of somebody that took a lot of phenomenological thought and came at a lot of Catholic truths from the phenomenological tradition. I would also hold up St. Benedict of the Cross,
Saint Teresa Benedict of the Cross.
Edith Stein, as another one that came from that phenomenological perspective. And so, I think what a Catholic phenomenologist would say is, you start from the standpoint of how man is created. Man is created in the image and likeness of God, and because of that, we share in the same rationality to a certain extent. Obviously not completely, mm-hmm. but to a certain extent of God. And it's from that then that we're able to understand and explore the world. And it leads to John Paul II's personalism. It leads to an understanding of the universe as something that is gradually revealed to us through revelation. So, you know, I think you wind up with a sort of a not contradictory theological position, but a different theological position, one that's kind of got a little bit of a different emphasis. So I would say you can definitely have faithful Catholic phenomenologists. Now, are there non-faithful Catholic phenomenologists? Yes, there definitely are. Are there non-faithful Catholic scholastics? Not anymore. I would say maybe once upon a time there were, right, but there aren't anymore.
Yeah.
Right. So that leads us now, I think, to the third question, and is the position of scientism, in other words, skepticism about metaphysical reality to begin with, is that in any way compatible with Catholicism?
Well, skepticism I would say it's problematic. Up to and including a point where it might be impossible, so because skepticism is a kind of spectrum, from just I have a little bit of doubt to I have radical doubt everything. So kind of depending where you fall in that spectrum. But I would say scientism itself is a kind of philosophical fallacy. It's a kind of error, because scientism itself makes the claim that the hard sciences, so your chemistry, your physics, your biology, it's the only source of truth of things, and so it excludes all sorts of other spheres of knowledge. So I would say if you wind up in if scientism really becomes your philosophy, you're going to find yourself excluding or denying lots of aspects of reality that are actually true. And I think C.S. Lewis has a really good book on scientism.
Yeah,
where he condemns it.
I guess if you define scientism in that strong of a sense, then definitely, you know, if you are sort of eliminating the possibility of religious experience, and you're eliminating the possibility of divine intervention into the universe,
or divine revelation,
it would exclude that because of its
reliance on empiricism,
right? But if you're merely taking it from an empirical sense, and empirically you recognize that there is revelation, empirically you recognize that the burning bush happened. You've got eyewitnesses of the burning bush. Moses said it happened. We don't necessarily have to doubt.
Yeah, but the scientism camp would dismiss holy scriptures. kind of generally out of hand?
I don't know. I would say probably a lot of, first off, you know, I think the default position is to a good extent scientism when it comes to metaphysics. And let's face it, the majority of people in the United States, contrary to what the media wants to portray, are still Christians. So, you know, you've got an awful lot of people that have a standpoint of deep, deep skepticism towards any type of metaphysical claims that are devout Christians. And I don't think it's just cognitive dissonance that's allowing that. I think there is a standpoint.
I think it might be. I think that's true. I'm not sure that.
No, I think there's a more weaker sense of scientism to where you're simply an empiricist. You're going to accept truths that present them to your senses, and religious truths are one variety of those truths that present themselves to your senses. We don't have scientific evidence, but we have historical evidence of the reality of Jesus. We have historical evidence of the reality of Noah's Ark. We have historical evidence of all sorts of stuff that was in the Bible that leads enough to us to be able to say, yeah, there's some hard, credible evidence that what is in the Bible is true. And so based on that, my religious beliefs can continue.
Well, I would say on that train of thought, though, that line of reasoning would be there's a kind of historical criticism that one can apply to, say, sacred scripture and then, say, validate certain aspects of sacred scripture, like people, places, names, but what that kind of historical empirical approach is going to leave behind, you won't be able to use a kind of empirical scientific method to arrive at the conclusion that God spoke to us or God became one of us.
But you can't use a hard historical method to establish that the Trojan War happened. Or you can't use a hard historical analysis to dictate that it was Brutus that killed Caesar. You know, there's a lot of knowledge that falls into mm-hmm. empirical knowledge that is third hand, fourth hand, fifth hand,
right.
That religious experience would fall within that. You can't use hard historical knowledge to understand that, to somehow prove that God spoke to Moses, but you can use historical analysis to recognize that a person named Moses existed, and Moses,
I would agree with that, Moses, right.
And Moses' claims yeah. seem valid. You know that what Moses claims seems to in some way have happened. Yeah, Moses is a credible witness, and according to Moses' testimony, this happened. So I don't think to be a scientist is to totally throw out the possibility of miracles and the miraculous, nor do I think it's to completely throw out the possibility of divine intervention.
Yeah, not completely, but I just think it's nearly impossible, though. So it's possible to do that, but it's I think it's extremely hard.
And yet you're extremely hard. Your impossibility, I would say, is the default position of the majority of Christians in this country, and probably even the majority of Catholics.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I think when we were talking about earlier, it might, I'm not sure a lot of us have spent much time even thinking about it. So I would want to investigate that a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think when you get into things like the Eucharist and you get into the sacraments and you get into the sacramental theology of Catholicism, I think that whole scientific empirical understanding of the universe becomes a little bit more difficult. You almost have to see
a lot more difficult, I would
well,
say.
But and in some ways, maybe you open your eyes to an insight that a lot of us that are a little bit more maybe metaphysically inclined overlook, and you have to see the sacraments as miraculous each and every time they happen. So when a baptism happens and somebody is received into the family of God, that's miraculous. That's divine intervention each and every time. I think some of us who are more metaphysically inclined might overlook that.
Yeah.
And we need to take a break. We'll be back with more of Metaphysics 102 on the Catholic Cave. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy. You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a voice for the church that's seldom heard in our chaotic world. We're confirmation for the strong of faith and encouragement and answers for those in doubt. We're there to rejoice with your triumphs and to be a voice of consolation through the dark times. We're a voice for vocations and proudly pro-life. We are Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then below that, in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Tim O'Donnell, Kent Blandford. We are talking about Metaphysics 102.
And we woohoo! Love 102s.
We are into our last metaphysical segment. And, you know, metaphysics is a very abstract science by definition. I mean, you're talking about...
To be or not to be.
Right.
See, I finally worked it in.
Yeah, but you're talking about propositions and judgments that are prior to experience that are in any way they're not going to empirically be explorable to a certain extent. So it's a very abstract science. So let's bring it down practically speaking. How does metaphysics interface with our ability to spread the gospel? You know, we were just talking about you know, that probably most people, they don't think about metaphysics at all. If they do, they most likely dismiss it and fall into some version of empirical scientism, even though still believing in religious revelation, believing in the Bible, believing in the church. They still would consider themselves, for the most part, empiricists. How do we go about evangelizing those that don't know God, that don't hold out the possibility for revelation, either gently introducing certain metaphysical principles or working around it altogether?
I like to, I don't know if I have a good answer to that. I haven't really thought about it that much, but I think one of the stumbling blocks, or there's three stumbling blocks that sort of causes one to reside in a practical atheism. And by practical atheism isn't meaning that one can act as if God and what flows from exists and kind of a practical denial of that on how one just doesn't have to care about it that much, acts that way. And I would say the three propositions that are often at work are this: the denial that God exists, the denial of free will, and the denial of the immortality of the soul. And I think it's the last one, the immortality of the soul, is a place in which sometimes we can begin a conversation, because it seems, I think, in our experience as persons, that we intuit that the human ourselves and others cannot be reduced to simply material organisms, and that what's going on in our intellects and in our wills are simply are reducible to mere biochemical reactions. And the way we can point that out to someone to come to that realization is asking a good question like, is love real? And if the answer to that is, do you really love something or someone? Have you been loved by someone? I think the vast majority of people are going to say, they're going to say yes. Well, love is not reducible. You can't locate love, I would say, in brain fizz, right, of some biochemical reaction that goes on between our ears. There's something more to it. And so that can open up a person to come to the realization that there are things that are not simply realities that are measurable by a scientific method of hypotheses, experimentation, looking at the data, and then affirming or denying conclusions. There's something more to life than that.
Right. And I think the universality of that experience as well. I think and I think there's other aspects of life that you can point to, sort of the universality that would transcend sort of empirical everyday life.
Sure. I mean, don't you really love your children?
Well, I think in today's day and age,
your spouse, your wife.
Well, I think in today's day and age too, a sense of justice is one of those that you can point people to. Of everybody recognizes injustice. There's a universal understanding of what is just and unjust. Now we may differ on descriptions of particular actions, whether they lead to
particular examples,
but we all recognize the fact that people's rights, universally, people have rights that can be trampled on. Just sort of universally. So I think you can kind of take it, and that
gets us back to divine forms and things like that.
Well, or it gets us back to sort of a priori propositions that come into play from a sort of phenomenological standpoint, right? But that universality of human experience and that universality of reason to a certain extent, you can also point to that, I think, as sort of evidence that empirical science does not cover all our bases. So I think you're right. Hitting those transcendentals of love, of goodness, of beauty, as experiences that are common to all of humanity in one form or another, and are experiences that we bring to experience. We see experience and we experience the world through the lens of those things and not vice versa, that I think you can also point to.
Yeah, I want to bring up, get your thoughts on this. I know we had talked about Immanuel Kant and phenomenology and what flowed from that. I think I would say personalism is a kind of one of the branches of phenomenology. One of the more interesting books that I've encountered, and it's by a thinker that you and I both, really appreciate a lot, is Alistair MacIntyre's book, God, University, and Philosophy. And in that, it's kind of a different book for him in that it's more of a kind of historical sweep of philosophy in the Catholic tradition over centuries. And I bring this book up because to get your thoughts, Mark, but also because that particular book, which is based on actually a course he taught at Notre Dame for a few years, allows for and he promotes this idea of what we've done a little bit on this show and other shows, which is this: in order to advance our knowledge and understanding, we have to engage in speculation. In other words, we have to continue to kind of push the frontier of knowledge if we're going to break new ground. And by definition, when you are out on the frontier, trying to, again, discover new ways of thinking or new knowledge and understanding, acquire it, you're going to make mistakes when you speculate. You're prone to it. And I think one of the things MacIntyre is advocating for in the book is that there has to be enough room, at least at the university level, and I would say at Catholic Radio Indy with this show, that we can try to push things a little bit in the direction of a sincere and authentic effort to discover more and more about the truth of things. And since God is inexhaustible truth, that's a worthy pursuit, but knowing in all humility that we can make mistakes along the way.
Right. And I think that's where the, going back to more scholastic understanding of things, I think that's where the will and a will that in some way is participating within the church. In other words, you're operating off of grace. You're in connection with the church, and your will is desiring more and more and more to understand God, to know God, to understand mankind, to understand the universe in which we live in, and not just to love Him more, but to love neighbor more. When that will is situated, I think that gives tremendous freedom to the intellect to be able to explore. And you know, I think there's a certain amount of questioning and skepticism that can come about from a standpoint of sincere, from a goodwill, I guess, from a standpoint of goodwill, there is a certain amount of doubt, of skepticism, of questioning that will lead to good fruit. I have to kind of agree with that.
Yeah, and I think there are guardrails, though. And I think about the previous show. So St. John Henry Newman reminds us, and I bring it up often because I need to remind myself often that reason can go wild. In other words, when we're speculating, we can, I think in large part due to our fallen nature, we can go off the rails. So our guardrails, which is a tremendous blessing here in the Catholic Church, is we have dogmas and doctrines that are settled, and those do create lanes in which we can operate and give us confidence and surety that we can propel ourselves forward into the frontier of new knowledge and understanding, where there's still vast, vast areas to be explored, but avoid the pitfalls of going too far into the realm of doubt, skepticism, or even cynicism, and waste a lot of time and effort in producing error.
Yep, and I think there's a difference between exploring and speculating and pushing the frontiers and maybe even breaking some boundaries to a certain extent in that process of speculating and teaching something that is erroneous as truth. I think there's a big difference between exploring and maybe holding as a possibility that it might be this way and running with
like
that.
Like God's a Trinity. There's no point in speculating if God's four persons.
Right.
You know, that's
waste. But I'll tell you what, though. But you know, if in the course of exploring what the meaning of the Trinity is,
correct.
You know, you kind of come to the question of, well, in order for the Trinity to be situated this way, there has to be some sort of fourth element to it. What might that be? Having that speculative thought is far different than going out and teaching and proclaiming publicly, well, there are four persons to the Trinity.
Yeah, or something that's shown up in the news recently too is some invalid baptisms that have caught baptisms were performed using innovation that was outside
Correct.
The guardrails.
Correct.
And therefore so innovative that they invalidated the actual baptisms themselves.
Right. I think that's a great example. You know, there's a difference between using a formula that's going to have invalid baptisms and speculating about the possibility of whether those formulas might be valid. You know, I think speculating about the possibility of whether those formulas might be valid is probably something worthwhile. It's probably worth running that through the ringer and trying to think through it and entertaining that idea for a little bit to but then going out and actually doing it without having gone through that process, I think is where the danger lies.
I think one of the formulations was the dreaded creator, redeemer, sanctifier. I've heard another blasphemous I don't want to say because it is kind of blasphemous, but there are some really crazy things
But I think McIntyre's point is the proper environment for that is the university. The proper environment for that is among professors in a
But even there needs to be guardrails, especially Catholic especially Catholic institutions, if they're going to be
proclaiming these things as truths. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. But if they're merely speculating about it, though, I would agree with McIntyre that there needs to be room for speculation.
Yeah, room for speculation. But guess what? I'll say no room for heresy. Down with heresy.
And with that, we come to the end of Metaphysics 102. For Professor Timothy O'Donnell, Professor Mark Tuttle, I'm the guy in the dunce cap, Kent Blanford. Until next time, class dismissed.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.